Okay, this morning I have been graciously invited by people here. Last night I spoke at Manila, which I enjoyed greatly, and I'm hoping to enjoy your company greatly this morning. I'm hoping also that there might be some time for some questions, so you can grill me if you have some thoughts of your own. What I want to talk about is the search for extraterrestrial intelligence. Now, I was actually involved with that for many years. In fact, I was the chairman of SETI Australia at one stage. And some of you might think, well, you know, there's a total madman standing in front there, in front of you. But the reality is that I wanted to talk about this because many of you don't perhaps understand what SETI is all about, and that's what I want to bring to you today. It was advertised as alien intrusion. And that is because the question really is there life out there? Now, it fires our imagination. There have been many films. There has been the Roswell incident in the 1950s. There's been E.T. There's been War of the Worlds. And there's been von Daniken in the 70s. who believed, as you see in the top right-hand corner, I might actually get this pointer. I think this should work. Yep. This here is some image that von Daniken found and claims that this really is an astronaut that has come, and that is his helmet in some particular way. So that was von Daniken. And there are a number of others. When I was a child, I loved reading about UFOs. I got every book out of the library and read about UFOs, unidentified flying objects, always wondered what they were. And so my interest goes back into alien life a long, long time ago. And so the real question before us is there life out there in some particular way? And let me give you the answer so that you know, don't sit there for the next 40 minutes wondering what the answer is. We don't know is the answer. So if you're hoping that I will have solved it this morning, I can't. We don't know. But the search for extraterrestrial intelligence is a serious scientific endeavour, in fact. The reason that we're looking for intelligent life is because we're interested in if there was life out there, how would it communicate? Well, if it's intelligent, at least there's a reason for communication. That's because it's intelligent. And then there'd be some way of knowing. And so that is where it started in the 1960s. Today it is being broadened out into a thing called astrobiology. It's astronomy and biology put together. And the question has become much bigger, and that is there any life out there? It's not just intelligent life. Is there any life out there? Microbial life? Maybe other animal life? And the answer to that question is we don't know. That's where we started. And that's probably where I'll finish as well. The reason it's important is because people are spending big money. So the Parkes Radio Telescope, which is not far away from here, is currently being used in a $100 million project called Project Breakthrough. And it's not that they've got $100 million, but they've got some millions of dollars, in fact, to do a five-year project between 2016 and 2021 that actually occupies 25% of the telescope time for targeted searches for the potential of life, any life out there in the universe. And it targets particularly the southern hemisphere because that's where we live. And it has a dramatic increase in the scope of what can be found. The parameter space is huge. How do we know that there's intelligent life out there? How do we know there's any life out there? What would you expect the communication to look like? How would you expect the thing to look? I mean, the famous line is simply, you know, if you were walking in a forest and you saw a table with a lovely tablecloth in it, you would immediately assume that there was somebody else there in the forest. Well, it's the same kind of problem. You're looking at the universe, you're looking at radio waves, you're looking at optical SETI. And the question, finally, the final question is, what is it that we're actually looking for? We're looking for something that is different to the normal astronomy, to the normal radio waves or the optical waves. That's what we're doing, basically. We're looking for signals that are unusual. Now, people have discovered unusual signals before. In 1967, Jocelyn Bell, who's now Professor Bell, she's retired, but she was the first discoverer in England of what's called a pulsar. And they were at first called, they first had the title LGM, Little Green Men, because the pulsar were regular pulses that she discovered coming from outer space. And initially people thought, oh, these pulses, that must mean something. But now they call PSR, which is pulsar, which is a bit boring. But basically people realise that they're like a beacon, a light beacon, from a rotating star, and the remnants of a rotating star. And so it's very difficult to decide whether there is life out there or not in some particular way. There are many spin-off advances, of course. There's always a good justification for why we spend so much money. And let me say immediately, this is not money that comes from governments. Most of the work being done in SETI today is being done by private funding. I'll come back to that, in fact. It's got nothing to do with governments. They've pulled out long ago, because the null result, we've been doing this work for 60 years, and so, you know, there hasn't been any positive results. Well, you can't keep asking for money for 60 years, believe me. Any of you who've been involved in any research whatsoever, it just doesn't work that way. You've got to have results, otherwise you're not going to get any more money. All right, so it's serious stuff. Now, you may in fact be surprised to know that already in the United Nations there has been adoption of particular protocols of what we should do were we ever to make contact with anyone. That happened in 1989. People take this seriously. And so there's a whole principles of concerning activities following the detection of extraterrestrial intelligence. That's been there, and of course there's protocol, who should we contact, how we should confirm that this is real, this isn't just some blip that occurred in the telescope somewhere and nobody else can find it. It also talks about, apart from cross-checking, it also says that we need to inform the Secretary General of the United States, lots of institutions, and of course the President of America. I don't think Australia figures in it somehow or other. But certainly the President of America is part of it. And so there's a whole protocol, and it's not hidden. All you've got to type in Google is something like SETI Declaration United States, and you'll get it. You can read it if you wish. It'll put you to sleep. But you can read it if you wish. You know, it's definitely there. Okay, now the possibility of life has always been tantalising for everyone. It's been a tantalising reality because the galaxy, and you will see it, maybe not right in Tamworth because it's a bit light pollution, but if you go out a little bit to Manila and you were to stand and watch the stars, you see this band of stars across the sky called the Milky Way. That's our galaxy. And there are over 100 billion stars in our own galaxy. But you know what's amazing is that there are over 100 billion galaxies. That is a lot of stars. In fact, if you were to try and work out how many stars, if you make every grain of sand a star, it would make a beach 100 metres wide, 10 metres deep and 1 million kilometres long.
God, that's
and that's the number of stars we think, give or take a few, obviously. It's not something that's exact. It's like counting jelly beans at fates. How many jelly beans in a jar? Well, you kind of estimate a small amount. And then what happens is you kind of scale it up and you hope you're somewhere near it and win the prize. It's the same kind of thing down here. And so the question really comes down, why can't one of these contain life? That's 10,000 billion, billion stars if you multiply those two numbers together. If you can still remember how to do that, it's not hard. You multiply those numbers together and you get 10,000 billion, billion. Couldn't one of these contain life? Any life. And perhaps life like us, intelligent life. And of course that's a very tempting possibility, because 10,000 billion, billion is a lot of stars, as I just said to you. Now, of course, many of these star systems have planets. The Sun is our local star. It's always a trick question. What is the closest star to us? The Sun is the answer. So next time you do, you know, something like Trivial Pursuit, just say the Sun, because that's the right answer. The nearest star after the Sun to us is Alpha Centauri. It's about 4.5 light years, and it's one of the pointers to the Southern Cross, in fact. It's the closest star after the Sun to us. It's amazing. Now, we know that many stars have planetary systems. We have a planetary system, and we know that as of the 1st of October this year, that there are 3,671 candidates. 606 actually have more than one planet, and this is a growing number that grows by the month as the star finders, as the planet finders actually go around and go looking for them. Now, that really, the suggestion is that there's likely to be at least a planet per star on the average, which, if we've got 10,000 billion billion stars, that's an awful lot of planets. It's 10,000 billion billion planets, in fact. And so, again, there's a tantalising draw, which is count one of these contain life, and any life, and life like us. So that's the carrot, in fact, that is there for all of us. We know in our own solar system, we know that the moon of Jupiter Europa is ice covered, and it's almost one of the two things that seem important for life is water and something that's carbon based. I know people saying, yeah, but you know, couldn't there be other forms of life, or potentially? But the reality is that carbon has the most what are called free radicals. Carbon makes the most compounds. In fact, it's a very interesting atom as such. So Europa has water. There's the potential perhaps that this moon has some ice in the ice or underneath some sort of life. We know in Mars that that's permafrost, it's cold. People have been doing lots of drilling to try and see if there was any kind of life at all, and the answer is no at the moment. Water has been found, and even compounds like methane have been found, but there's no sign of life. The jury is out, in fact, in terms of life. The other things that are draw cards are, in fact, that you can find the fingerprints, they're called spectra, of stars, and you can find the spectra of the interstellar material. Now, that's the space, in space. There are molecules floating around in space. And they are organic molecules, and those organic molecules include sugars, they include a whole lot of other complicated names, which I won't bore you with, but these are some of the building blocks that one could imagine was necessary for life. And so although they're very, very sparse, the vacuum in space is better than any vacuum we can make on Earth, in fact. And yet, nevertheless, there are enough molecules out there to begin tempting to believe that, in fact, organically, that ought to be possible. And the concept is one called panspermia, and that's basically the idea that dirty ice balls called comets collect these things, and that somehow or other they are the precursor for life. Now, don't be too immediately jump to the conclusion that this is automatically means that there is life. Just because you've got the molecules does not mean that you can form the DNA, which is so seminal that is necessary, because it builds machinery, biological machinery, and nobody, even the most ardent atheists like Richard Dawkins, has an answer to that question. So it's one thing to say, well, there are the chemicals. Another thing to say, this automatically means that there must be some sort of life. Because people have done studies on this, they've taken the basic chemicals, and sure, you can do all sorts of things that make the chemicals combine into something like amino acids, but going up the other slope, which is proteins, nobody knows the answer how that's formed. So it's tempting, but don't immediately conclude that we have the answer, therefore, to the fact of life. And on top of that, anyway, even if this is so, and even if, as some people suggest, that life has started on earth because of something like this, the question still is, why and where does that come from then? All it does is shift, it's shifting sort of ducks, that's all it is. You haven't still got the answer. Okay, so that idea of life starting everywhere as a possibility is a serious suggestion. It's not made by people who are not serious astronomers. We do find that Sir Fred Hoyle, in fact, posited this idea at the Royal Society in London because he felt that the evolutionary biology, which simply said time plus chance ultimately plus nothing, was like human life coming out of a 747 coming out of a junkyard. So he couldn't see it himself. And so he proposes this panspermia concept. It only shifts the problem further out, but it may be a potential answer, as he thought. Now let me move from what the tantalizing possibility of there being some sort of life out there to what is the motivation behind this? What is the motivation behind SETI? Why is it that people like Yuri Milner, who's a Russian entrepreneur, is the one who's put up $100 million for this project breakthrough? It was announced not only by him, but with Stephen Hawking, in fact, who's that famous physicist, wheelchair confined, who wrote A Brief History of Time. You've all got the book, but none of you have read it because it's too hard. Now, am I touching nerves? Because that's usually what the problem is. Everybody's got it, but it's hard to read. Okay, so Yuri Milner spends $100 million, and similarly, Paul Allen, who is the gentleman at the bottom, he's an American entrepreneur, he's worth billions as well. He spends $11.5 million, puts up and the SETI Institute in California, which is privately funded, builds an array of telescopes, calls it, guess what? The Allen Telescope. And this is as I said last night to the people, if you want to be famous and you happen to have lots of money, then the CSIRO or any university in Australia will accept your money and you'll have a room named after you, maybe even a building. That's how desperate we've become. The question is, why continue 60 years of research? Okay, it's privately funded. It's people's personal money that they're putting down and wanting to do this. It must ask deep questions, which I want to move to. I want to move in this direction because it does ask deep questions about, well, what's the motivation behind it? Well, I believe that scientific SETI and just our concepts of UFOs and aliens and so forth is as much about our own place in the universe. Where do we fit into the universe? And I think the motivation is as much about, are we alone? I remember once I went to a lecture on SETI, and the lecturer suggested out the front that perhaps we are alone, perhaps we're the only intelligent species in the universe. And a couple of people shouted out, "Rubbish!" You know, it's because there's no answer whether we are alone or not, but people find it hard to believe, and there is a sense in which we are searching for our own place and identity. It's a big word, it's an existential question. Existential simply means we are trying to find our place. We have to make sense of life in some way. As one of my friends in Labrie said, it's like coming into a movie theatre and the film has already begun, and you are called out of the movie theatre before the film has ended, and you have to make sense of reality, of that film in the middle. And for many people, that's life. You're born and you die, and you see your relatives die, or you see children born, and there is the flow of history that makes you. But what does it all mean? what is ultimately ultimate meaning and value. And that is part of the motivation that lies behind this. If we're not alone, what would that mean? You see? Now there's almost no chance, even if we discover that life exists, of communicating. Because we say that the nearest star is 4 light years away. That means that light has taken 4 and a bit light years to actually come from that star here. That's travelling at the speed of light. Light is the fastest thing we know. If I say 21, which is approximately 1 second, light has already gone around the Earth 7.5 times. That's the speed. And this takes 4 years. And in fact, if you wanted to go to Alpha Centauri system, it is a couple of stars and a large planet-like body nearby, you can do the calculation. Well, I can do the calculation. And that is to work out how long it would take you to get there. And all right, so you travel at the escape velocity from the sun, which is 151,000 kilometres per hour. It would take you, still would take you 30,000 years to get to the nearest star. It's a long way away. And so the question is, are we alone? Yes, okay, even if you can answer the question that we're not alone, the reality is there's no way of communicating. I Love Lucy was on 50 years ago. Well, that's just getting 50 light years away if it's still able to be received. So they see old episodes. Of things that we used to see in the 60s. It's a quest, in fact, to understand our own cosmic place. That's really what drives many people to be involved in this kind of thing. Who are we and where do we stand? It's a question of origins. And you will know that humankind as a whole has been interested in this question since time immemorial. You can get lots of books from Amazon or wherever, that look at creation myths from all cultures. All cultures have some understanding of their place, where they came from, who they are. And in our case, you can go to Aboriginal culture and you will find that as well. Our stories are important to us in terms of who we are. Heroic legends and stories that give us our place involve complex relationships between us and the gods. And people believe some sense of transcendence in reality. And so this is very important to us. Now, what are the basic questions that we ask as humankind? And it is us who ask this question. The gorillas and the chimpanzees and the orangutans in Taronga Park Zoo are not asking these questions. They are the closest relatives to us genetically, 1.4% difference. But they're not sitting there, you know, with books and, you know, with coffee and with tablecloths and with glasses on and with, you know, thinking about reality, because that's not their problem. That is a human problem. And the questions that we ask ourselves, and this comes from time to time in our lives, it's not automatic, not everybody's thinking about these things all the time, but questions like, who am I? Where do I fit in the universe? Why do we need meaning and significance? Why are we able to comprehend the universe? What is it about us that allows us to understand the universe? You know, we can make theories up, we can make measurements, we can understand how things work. This is very unique, in fact, that ability to be able to look at our place and to think abstractly and to think forward and backward in time, to be able to ask these kind of questions is deeply a part of our reality. Why do I struggle to exist? Why is life so hard? And I've thrown the bit in on physical entropy, but I won't explain it. It's too hard, but I threw it in because I thought it looked nice. Why is the form of the universe so structured that we can exist? The universe is finely tuned. One of the realities that's been discovered, physicists like doing this crazy thing, theoretical physicists, and I fancy myself as a theoretical physicist, theoretical physicists love making universes mathematically on paper. They're cheap. I mean, all you need is pencil and paper, that's all you need. But the reality is people like Stephen Hawking did this back in the 1970s. And the one thing that he and his colleagues discovered was that it might well be, you can make all sorts of universes, but to make a universe like us, to make a universe in which we can exist, is very, very finely tuned. You can change the gravitational constant and you will not have the planets and stars that we do. You can change various other constants and you won't get the elements that we have. And some of these things are tuned to one part in 10 to the 120. Now, 10 to the 120 is 1 with 120 zeros in it. So it's one part in 1 with 120 zeros in it. That's how finely tuned we are. And the immediate question is, why? Is it because we just got lucky? That's one explanation by a lot of people. And other people like myself and many other physicists who are not necessarily Christians will say, no, this is too good to be true, in fact. And it's a recognition that this universe is rather special. The laws, the principles, the mathematical logic, it's a rational universe. It's a universe open to being measured and discovered and has a rational, reasonable laws. And this, of course, is, as someone has said, is because God is a mathematician. I kind of like that. We discover it. We don't create it. We discover the reality. It is there before us. It's the nature of being, in fact. Okay, but you know, it's not just the universe that we live in that is amazing. I want to say to you, you are amazing. One of the things that we seem to be doing madly in our society is continually saying that we're nobody. But it's just not true. If I look at and compare humankind, and this is not an arrogant position, it's just simply a comparison between ourselves and the animal kingdom, and we are part of the animal kingdom too, but there's something unique about us. And what sort of things is that uniqueness? Creative, art, drama, music, literature, science, mathematics, engineering. To need to love, to have meaning, to have value, to have significance. These are not questions that are being asked by other animals. They're being asked by humankind. To build monuments that live on after us. To write down history. To search for our roots. To somehow be eternal and have an everlasting impact. So, you know, you may not believe that God exists at all, for argument's sake, but a nice monument would be good, wouldn't it? And some people look to their children, perhaps, to the genetic continuation of children and grandchildren, perhaps. But other people have monuments built to them. Other people have statues or buildings that say something, if you look on the plaques, oh yes, I kind of remember that guy who put down the money. And that's part of the reality, to have an internal and everlasting impact, to make a difference, to build, to understand, to make changes, to make life more comfortable. These are things that we do as human beings. To understand technology, to desire morality, to create institutions which make laws, to have freedoms, to be just and fairly treated. In fact, these are things that we do as human beings, and it is amazing. We have forgotten how amazing we are as human beings. And so here we are, we live in a universe that has form and structure and information and is finely tuned. And here we are sitting here thinking about all these things, amazing. And the question ultimately comes, why is this so? I'm old enough to remember Julius Sumner Miller. And he was in fact part of Sydney University when I was there as a student, in fact. So I met him, and he was always asking this question, why is this so? And I'm putting this to you this morning. That is, wherever you are in the spectrum of thinking about these things, the reality is the universe is amazing, and we are amazing, and the question now comes, why is this so? Now you can immediately say, oh well, it's just an accident of history. But what I want to show you is this. Over here is atheism. There is no God. Over here is theism. There is a God. And many people have used science and pulled it in the direction of atheism. But actually, science is closer to theism, because science points to these kind of questions and looking for these kinds of answers for why this is so. But there's also a dark side to being human, so I don't just want to say it's this reality. There's also a dark side to being human. There are wars, there is self-centeredness, there's control and manipulation. It's the boss, of course, if you're working for someone, it's always the boss who's doing this. But you don't do these things at home. You're all nice people. There's megalomania, the desire to be looked up to be top of the tree, to be rich or greedy, perhaps, to define our own morality. That's the latest thing that's happening. That we, in our existential reality, that is, in the reality of making sense of life that we live, that we can define our own morality, and we can define our own standards, and we can do our own gender now. We can even define whether we're a man or a woman. That seems to me ludicrous, because 99.99% of people are either born XY, which turns out therefore to be a man, or XX, which turns out to be a woman. There is a very small percentage of people, 0.001%, who are XXY. But they're not the ones who are trying to shape our culture at the moment. That's not them. They have other problems as well. Okay? But all I'm saying is that science reality tells us there are certain things that are true, and yes, we might believe that we can do whatever we like, but it's not so. It matters whether you believe in gravity or not. It does, really. It matters that you walk through doors and not through walls. It doesn't go very easily. Try it sometime. The wall doesn't allow you through. It matters because the universe has boundaries which are set there because the universe has form. As such. All right, the question I asked before is, why is this so? Why do we have a universe which is rational and has beings like ourselves? Science has tried naturalism. Naturalism, as I said, is simply an atheistic position which simply says, look, I can explain everything in terms of other things, naturally. That's the argument. Basically, only natural explanations will do. And ultimately, however, there is no simple natural explanation to the why. Why is the universe like this? Why are we like this? You see, now I know there are multiverses. I don't have time to talk about these kind of issues. I can answer questions afterwards if those of you want to linger on and keep talking about these things. But the fundamental question is why? You see, being a scientist, I'm interested in how things work. But that also, I'm also interested in the why, you see. And it always seems to me odd that people say, oh, well, I'm interested in how things work, but I don't want to know why. It just seems to me such an odd position. And then to say, well, there are no answers, that's nonsense. There are very good rational answers that one can consider. And it's one of the reasons why I have chosen Christianity, and I'll show you why. At the moment, we, in many places in our society, we're living in a room without windows, and we're groping around trying to find answers to who we are and why we do what we do. And we're just going around the wall. What we actually need is some windows. We need to open the curtains, we need to open the window to allow light from the outside to give us potential answers to the groping around that is so much part of our lives. And I want to simply say to you that the Bible gives us the simplest and the best window we need to explain the why of the universe. The infinite personal God, Yahweh, described by the Hebrews outside of our space and time, created the universe with its form and us with characteristics of self-consciousness like himself. That is a very good answer. Now, people may not agree. I am not worried about that. But to say it's not rational is nonsense. It's perfectly rational to believe that there is an outside being who has created the form of the universe and us in his likeness. Now, I can live with the fact that people don't agree. What I'm concerned about is that stations like the ABC don't even give that the time of day. They think that's just a lifestyle choice. It's nonsense. It's a perfectly good, rational answer. And I have spoken to university audiences and argued this case, in fact. I've spoken to the Atheist Society at Sydney University and made these points. It's a perfectly good answer, even if you don't want to accept that as a choice for yourself, that is an answer. But I would want to say to you, it's a pretty good answer. And therefore, I would want to adjure you to actually, if you haven't considered it before, to take a second look at it, because it's a darn good answer that there is a God who's revealed himself and we are in his image. It's a serious option, as I keep saying to people, in fact. Now, of course, the immediate rejoinder is, and the God of the Bible, that's nice, but why? You know, I was sitting next to a Hindu man at a function in Bathurst, speaking at a men's dinner, and this Hebrew man said to me, he was a doctor, and he said to me, "You Christians are so arrogant." And I said, "Why?" He said, "Well, because you believe you're the only way to God. Surely there are multiple paths to God. We're just one of many. So why do you keep saying that you're the only one? You arrogant lot," you see. And I said to him, "Yes, I agree with you that we would be arrogant. But for one thing," I said to him, "and that is that religions aren't all actually the same. We're not all travelling the same path on the same on the mountain to this God. The unique difference is that in Christianity, God has come to us." Whoa, that's different. You know, it's not just us tramping up the mountain together, and there's my Islamic friend, and over here's my Hindu friend, or whatever. We're all getting there. We'll all get there eventually, and we'll all discover that it's the same. But the reality is this, that Christianity says, no, it's not quite like that. The God who's made 10,000 billion stars, who gives us the form and who gives us our nature, has actually come to us in the person of Jesus. Now, of course, I can't hope in this short time to completely unpack that for you. All right? If you're interested, and you can keep talking to me. But the reality is that God has come to us in Jesus. That's the Christian message. And that's amazing. Jesus is the space-time projection of God and has shaped 2,000 years of Western history. We live in that reality. Well, there are lots of people who are not Christians, but we have adopted in our culture many, many values which have impacted our culture. And what I think is so tragic today is that people are throwing all that away, or want to throw all that away, without actually a serious discussion. And I'm glad for people like Andrew Bolt, who's a journalist, and who says he's not a Christian, who's prepared to say, "Whoa, wait a minute, this is not exactly trivial, what you're doing." In fact, you see? And it's important, this kind of thing. We are actually not alone, that's my point. So we may or may not know what's going to happen in terms of there being other beings, but we're not alone. Because there is a God, and he calls us into relationship with him. And the important point here, not on our terms, but on his terms. This is a tragedy, you know, lots of people think they can do it their way. Well, anyone who can create 10,000 billion stars is not trivial and needs to be listened to. Okay, it's not something that you can just do on your own terms. His terms, accepting Jesus' willing execution. I'm deliberately using different words to kind of shock you into realising what all this means. Accepting Jesus' willing execution at the hands of evil men and counting this as a sufficient sacrificial gift that he made in our place for our real moral guilt before God. Now, you've almost got to read that several times, that sentence. I couldn't compact it any more. than what I'm trying to get at. And receiving new and everlasting life modeled by Jesus' resurrection from death. Many, many people want a fresh start. And Jesus and God through Jesus are saying, I'm here. I will give you a fresh start. I will give you a new spirit which will change the way you act and think. In fact, now those of us who are Christians have experienced this, that we have changed the way we act and the way we think about things. And this is from God himself. So we're not alone. Whatever the outcome, as I've said, of the scientific SETI, the very hunger for human meaning is actually not found in SETI as such. It's actually in a very different place. There's a God called Yahweh. In Hebrew, there are no vowels. In the original, they use diacritical marks. And the name of God is so holy, the Hebrew are so holy, that in fact there are no vowels. And they use little marks to indicate what vowels might have been there. And this makes it hard to read, believe me. But this is very much that is there. And Hebrew is one of the early languages, in fact. He created and formed the universe. We are in his image. We are in rebellion. He wants relationship with us on his terms. And we are not alone. We are actually loved. He actually wants a relationship with us. Now, this is not rocket science. I like rockets. When I was a child, I was always interested in rockets. And I used to design rockets. And I even tried to make some. Not always. I used to get things like master cylinders, brake master cylinders, and then fill it up with gunpowder and things like that, you see, and then put it on little carts and light them, you see, just they fly along like this, you see. I'm lucky that I'm still here. The reality is that this is not rocket science. God makes sense. As I've said to you, science actually points beyond itself and resonates more closely with the idea that there is a God and that we are in his image, that we are not alone, whatever the outcome of SETI might be. And as I said right at the beginning, we don't know whether there's life out there or not. But it really makes no difference in terms of our humanity as such. I'll leave you with something that we used earlier, that we read earlier. And just the first part of it, which comes out of Psalm 19. The heavens declare the glory of God. If you stand away from the city lights, the sky is magnificent. The skies proclaim the work of his hands. Day after day they pour forth speech. Night after night they display knowledge. There is no speech or language where their voice is not heard. Their voice goes out into all the earth, their words to the ends of the world. The reality is that it's silent, but it's not. It speaks. The reason why people are religious, why humankind is religious, is because of this truth, that as we stand and look out there, it's amazing. We see something beyond ourselves. And I want to proclaim to you that this God who I worship and many of you here worship, that this God is worth a second look. And really does give us the answers to why we are the way we are and why the universe is the way it is. And as I said, we are not alone. Thank you. Thank you.